Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
At first glance, it seems like these students at St. Francis of Assisi in Burien are dressed pretty much alike. White-collar shirts, red plaid skirts for the girls, navy blue pants or shorts for the boys. But if you look closer, you'll see that each of these 5th through 8th graders has brought a little something special to their outfit.
I'm probably like the only boy in the school that you'll see wearing a headband.
Pretty sure I'm the only girl, really, who wears pants every day.
I wear a gold watch, keep track of the time, always got to know where you got to be.
For me, I have white Adidas Superstars that I've wore all year.
I guess I like to wear sweatshirts, and usually I wear dirty Toms.
I tend to wear a leather jacket. I also wear my Converse. I have a different pair of Converse every year, and I wear it for the whole entire year.
And the 2017-18 Converse are?
Blue with pen marks on them.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And these kids say the longer you spend here, the more those unique little adornments stand out. Here's 6th grader Rachel Fry.
They think, oh my gosh, they're all the same. They're all wearing the same uniform. But when you're actually in your peer group, you start to realize that people have their own different styles. Not everybody is the same.
But standing out for your own style does come with risks. 8th grader Gwendolyn Schaefer says that's especially true if your choice comes off as challenging social norms.
For picture day, I decided to wear a vest and a tie. And apparently that's a bit of a scandal for a woman to wear a tie. And the thing is, I really like to wear a tie. And it was a really nice tie, too. It was my dad's. And so when everyone was just kind of asking, Gwen, why are you wearing a tie? I just told them, because I felt like it.
Does that satisfy them?
No.
Gwendolyn does not care for school uniforms. But not everyone here feels that way exactly. Take 8th grader Gino Morella, our gold watch fan.
I don't think I would be able to live without my uniform, because when you don't have a uniform, many people are thinking, oh, I got to wear this because I'm going to impress. I don't want that person to say I'm ugly. I don't want this person to say, you know. So with the uniform, I don't need to worry about wearing something different. Just it's hard now going into high school because most Catholic high schools do not have uniform, and I just don't know what to wear. It's like I've never had clothes.
In the end, it's a pretty complex balance these kids have to strike. They get conflicting messages. Well-meaning grown-ups say, be yourself, be proud of who you are. But at the same time, Gino says there are all these subtle messages from adults and peers not to stray too far from the norm.
They want you to be who you are, but not too much of who you are, or they don't like you. It's hard to choose whether you want to be yourself and maybe people won't accept you, or just be another person and call it good, you know.
Today on the show, our theme is one of many, the tension between standing out and fitting in. We'll hear what it's like to be the lonely doubter in a sea of fans and the practitioner of a dying art. It's all ahead on Sound Effect from 88.5. As a kid, Christopher Polis didn't dream of being an astronaut or a race car driver. He dreamed of being a lawyer. His attorney grandfather was his idol, and he found himself fascinated, even as a young kid, by the human dramas that played out in court. But as an adolescent, some hard realities caught up with him. His parents had split up, there was alcoholism and abuse in his home, and Polis found comfort in drugs and alcohol.
As soon as the substance hit my bloodstream, or even just feeling the warm alcohol going down to my throat, I immediately felt a huge sense of relief and ease. It was literally the sensation of, and I immediately was the life of the party. And I chased that for about a decade.
Polis would eventually come back around, determined not to become one of the many stuck in a vicious cycle of addiction and prison. These days, he heads up Washington's statewide reentry council, which pushes to improve outcomes for people coming out of incarceration. But before that, Polis would have to struggle through dark days. culminating in a relentless series of traumas in his last year of high school.
My grandfather, the attorney who played such a pivotal role in my life, lost a long battle with cancer, and I held him as he left this life. And a couple months after, we got a call from the Coast Guard that my stepdad's boat was missing at sea. And while the boat was missing, one of my friends had gotten into a drunken fist fight, and the person he kind of got the better of grabbed a kitchen knife and took his life. And then we got the call from the Coast Guard saying they found my stepdad's body floating in the Atlantic Ocean. And this was all my senior year of high school, so I'm 18 on the dot and had these three consecutive tragedies. After those, I completely felt like I just needed to be in a constant state of blackout. My mom didn't know how to handle my behavior and had me leave the family home. So I found myself as a high school senior in the winter in Portland, Maine, homeless. And one day I was at a place called Jay's Oyster Bar in Portland, Maine, right on the waterfront. And I was drinking glass after glass of rum. And I felt exactly the same as when I sat down, where normally, even with my tolerance, I would be highly intoxicated. And it was at that moment that I realized my solution, the drugs and alcohol that had provided me relief for so many years, were no longer providing any type of relief. And within about 3 or 4 weeks after that, I found my way into treatment. I got a job. I didn't love the job, but it was telemarketing. And when I got sober, my childhood dreams began to return. And those were things that I had really surrendered. And so my dream of practicing law began to return in early sobriety. So in my little cubicle, what I did was I put up a little yellow stick-it note that I still have to this day. And the company I worked for was called Festiva Resorts. And the post-it note said, lawyer or Festiva. And then in all capital letters, it said, focus. My mom had taken me back into the family home, and we were starting to repair our relationship between the two of us and with the rest of the family. And about 6 months in, I'm getting ready for work, and I get a private phone call. Mr. Poulos, this is Special Agent Matt so-and-so, FBI, Boston. Why don't you take a look outside your window and then come on out? So I'm at my childhood home. My brother, who's 10 years younger, is out front playing with a friend. And I open the shades and I see that the house is surrounded by federal agents. During my active addiction, I sold cocaine, and my past came back to haunt me. Apparently someone I had sold it to was in trouble and they wore a wire. And I called my family and friends and was able to get enough money to hire a very well-connected, competent, and very expensive private counsel. And that affected the entire outcome, not just that day, but of my entire case and how much time I ended up having to serve. And it deeply bothered me at the core that I was leaving jail and all of these people were staying behind simply because they did not have the privilege that I had on that particular day. And most of those people were lower income white folks and people of color. And it was that moment that I became determined once again, and truly the fire within me was born to become an attorney, regardless of how long they sentenced me to prison. My prison sentence ended up being just under 3 years, and as soon as I got out of prison, I went back to that same job, telemarketing, put my note up again years later that said Festiva or Lawyer Focus. And I worked in that call center every night, and I went to college every day. There are a lot of challenges for anyone with a federal felony record to A, even getting into law school. There's a perception among society that people who have been incarcerated, and I don't use language like this, but people still say offender, ex-convict, convict, all these words that further perpetuate stigma and place us into the category of other. Largely, that means that people are destined only for certain jobs. The opposite of what we're supposed to do in a correctional system is like, I went to prison, I paid my debt in full. Why am I not being welcomed back? I went and met with the dean of the law school where I wanted to attend, and we had a conversation. And so I said to him, you know, my mom was a single mom, and he's nodding. And I said, okay. And, you know, I was homeless for a period as a teenager. He's nodding. He's saying, okay. And said I had major issues with alcohol and drug addiction. And he's still kind of nodding. And then I said I was incarcerated for a multiple-year federal prison sentence as a result of decisions I made during my active addiction. Immediately, I felt like a wall came up between us. And he suggested alternative career paths. And so I chose my words very carefully. And I think for the first time in my life, I stood up for myself and I said, why didn't the judge give me a life sentence? And he was surprised by my question. He said he wasn't sure. So I looked at him right in the eye and I said, so then, Dean, why are you giving me a life sentence here today? And when I said that, I feel like the wall that had been built between us, it didn't come tumbling down, but a few bricks fell off the top. And after that meeting, the admissions committee ultimately voted unanimously in my favor. And the dean, who I had had that initial meeting with, he chaired the committee and ultimately became a great ally and acquaintance, maybe even friend. I ended up being appointed to this local city task force on substance use and on addiction. And the director of national drug control policy at the time, Michael Botticelli, under President Obama, was going to come and speak to our committee in Portland, Maine. And he starts to speak, and he said that he was an openly gay, married man in recovery from addiction who had been to jail. He didn't say it in a cocky way, but he said it without fear. He said it without shame. And it floored me when he said that openly. And I was still very private at that time. Only my closest friends and family knew anything about my background. After that, I told him, I said, I've never heard someone speak openly like that about their recovery. I thought we were supposed to hide it and be ashamed of it and everything else. And I'd love to come to Washington sometime. And I began the process of applying to work full-time at the Office of National Drug Control Policy a year or so later. I'd gotten a tentative offer from the White House, but waiting for my clearance. And it didn't look good because it should have happened already. And I thought, oh God, they're just putting it off so that I'm just going to go away, I guess. And I get a private call. And remember, I've had a private call from the federal government before. And the guy says, Mr. Poulos, do you have a minute? And I said, of course, yes, I'll make time. He says, this is, so-and-so from the United States Secret Service. I don't normally call applicants, but I found your background and your work and your path so fascinating that I wanted to call you and congratulate you. You're in, and we need you to report to duty for the President of the United States. I was so awestruck with going into those spaces When I would walk into the White House, just going into the Eisenhower Executive Office Building or even the Office of National Drug Control Policy, there was a part of me that said, do I really belong here? Do I really? And I had to kind of convince myself. And it was important for me personally, but I think it was so much more important that I walked through that with grace, because it provided that opportunity for other people. It provided hope. And of course, not everyone who's been incarcerated is going to go to law school or be able to intern at the White House, but we can.
Christopher Polis is the executive director of Washington's Statewide Reentry Council. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is One of Many. So, sorry to make you do this, but try and think back to the last time you got some really bad news. It's easy to feel helpless and alone. Well, that's how Nicole Price felt when she was 25 years old and found out that she was infected with HIV.
Well, I was afraid of dying. I was afraid of never being able to have kids, never, you know, being married. People, my family not loving me anymore. It was a really scary time.
It took a while, but Nicole eventually found comfort in the company of many other women like herself. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing has the story.
Nicole Price knew it was time to get tested for HIV after a visit to the hospital to check in on her ex-boyfriend. Even though they weren't dating anymore, they still cared for each other. When she got there, she wasn't quite prepared for what she saw.
He was hooked up to a lot of different tubes and IVs, and he was very skinny, very pale. He had some sores on his mouth. And it took about 3 weeks for us to figure out that he indeed had an AIDS diagnosis. He had tears in his eyes. He felt really guilty.
This was in Santa Rosa, California. It was the year 2000, and HIV no longer meant you were going to die. And even though the news Nicole was infected was difficult for her to absorb, she wasn't surprised by the results.
2 years before that, my sister and I had taken my dad out for Father's Day for breakfast. And that night, I got really ill, and I thought, well, maybe I just have food poisoning or something. But it ended up lasting for 3 weeks. And I couldn't shower. I couldn't eat anything.
You were really sick.
I was very sick. And I had went to the doctors, you know, to get checked out. And they basically said, well, it's just a virus. You got to let it run its course. Well, boy, was it. That was probably when my body was trying to fight off the HIVs. And it's when I converted from being HIV negative to HIV positive.
When Nicole found out that she had HIV, she wasn't using needles, but she was 7 years into an addiction to meth. So here she was in her mid-20s, an addict who had a hard time holding down a steady job. And now this, a virus that required her full attention. Nicole realized she had to make some changes.
My case manager at the time was really, really harping on me about, you know, if you don't take your meds every single day and on time, you'll build up resistance and then they won't work for you anymore. So that really scared me. And so I knew that it was time.
Nicole quit meth, but in order to stay clean, she had to leave Santa Rosa behind. So she headed north to Seattle to live with her mother. And by the way, Nicole's earlier fears of being rejected by her parents, they were completely unfounded. Both her mom and her dad did their best to reassure her and tried to find ways to help.
My mom did a lot of research, and she found Babes Network.
Babes Network is an organization for women who are living with HIV. It started back in 1989. Its founders say that during that horrible time when HIV was sure to lead to AIDS, women with HIV were not really finding their people. A lot of the groups back then were geared more towards upper middle class gay white men. So one night, 13 HIV-positive women got together over a potluck dinner and decided to create their own group, Babes with AIDS. Again, this was 1989, when AIDS was the expected final chapter. Fast forward to the year 2004. Nicole goes to her first Babes meeting. She is overwhelmed. Going to a support group just for women with HIV makes her diagnosis more real than it already was. But she kept going back.
And I met the executive director at the time, and she said, you know, I know you haven't been positive very long, and you've only been clean for a little over a year, but would you want to work here? I'm like, well, I like people. I'm a forklift driver, or a waitress, like, got a degree in computers, has nothing to do with social work, but sure.
Nicole led support group meetings and organized lots of outings.
We'd go ice skating or go bowling or have a Halloween party.
Kind of to break people out of that cloud.
Right. Because women are really affected by this disease differently, because generally women put everything else first, just women in general, right? So your family, your kids, your job. So it's really important that, especially HIV positive women, that they're taking care of their health, because if they're not taking care of their health, then they're not going to be able to do all of those other things and take care of all of those other aspects of their life. So it's kind of like the whole person.
Today, Nicole is one of about 700 women living with HIV in King County. And those support groups that Babes started back in 1989, they're still going. They meet at the YWCA in downtown Seattle.
Should we just go around and say how we've been doing this week?
On this particular day, Pat Migliori, one of Babes' founding members, checks in with six HIV-positive women sitting in a circle.
If you like the theme of having a rose, something that's good, having a bud, something that's coming up that's good, mm-hmm. and having a thorn, something that's bad, mm-hmm. that's happened in the past week. So who would like to start?
An older woman named Dorothy unloads her thorn. It's a man, her partner. She's trying to break things off with him, but it's hard. Dorothy tells the group that he just overdosed on heroin and survived.
The doctor asked him how come he wanted to kill himself. He said, because I left him. Don't put that on me. I said, because I'm trying to help you. I'm not trying to push you farther in the ground. I'm trying to help you. And you're going the other way. And it's hard for me to do this. I'm just tired. I haven't been to church. I don't feel like combing my hair. I don't feel like anything. I feel like I'm a failure. And why go on? Why go on? So I have that thorn. But my rose is my grandson. And that's where I'm at today.
At this meeting, the things that are shared go back to what Nicole was talking about earlier, addressing the whole person. If someone has emotional backup and support, they're more likely to stay on track with their medication. Today, Nicole Price is the program manager for Babes. She leads the organization. She doesn't really know which direction her life would have gone if she hadn't been diagnosed with HIV and found this community.
It's not like I'm excited to have it or I want to have it, but it's really made my life amazing. I've got to meet so many wonderful people. I've got to do so many things, like go to Washington, D.C. and advocate for people living with HIV. And I speak in schools and prisons. And so, yeah, none of that would have ever happened if I wasn't diagnosed. So in a way, it was a blessing.
Do you think you would still have an addiction if you didn't get diagnosed?
But quite possibly, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird, but it sounds like it saved your life.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot has changed since Babes first started. Instead of planning funerals, pink and blue balloons are now bought for baby showers. Some of the women have been living with HIV for 35 years, others for 3 months. Some are homeless, others are solidly middle class with jobs at Boeing. And yes, this is a social service organization, but Nicole says she doesn't call the women she serves clients. She says they are members. And every time a new member walks through the front door, they go from being alone to being embraced by this sisterhood, a sorority bonded by a virus.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're telling stories about what it's like to be one of many. In this next story, we are going to slow down a little bit and enter the quiet world of the King County Public Library System's bookmendery. Essentially, it's a hospital for books. The workshop is on the first floor inside the library's headquarters in Issaquah, and this is where thousands of broken books have been made whole again by Donald Voss.
It is gratifying to take a book that's been damaged, broken, seemingly ready to die, but handling those parts, manipulating them in such a way with other better materials is like rehabilitation upon a person, a down and out person, who, but then is given a better chance through some means and finds his strength again.
It's taken Donald 27 years to hone his craft. He says it's really just in the last 5 years that he's been able to approach any damaged book with confidence. Some arrive showing signs of being loved a little too well by generations of readers. Others have broken spines, or in book repair speak, broken hinges, after one too many tosses into the return bin. Donald repairs between 100 and 200 books a week, and he's one of the last people left in public library systems whose sole job is repairing books. Books have been around for thousands of years, and the way they get repaired hasn't changed very much over that time.
And it's striking to me that I don't see much of anything that plugs in.
Exactly.
Needles and thread are at the ready in case a book needs some careful hand stitching. Presses work like a vise to keep pages in place once special glues have dried.
So you put them in this press and crank it down, and this affords hundreds of pounds of pressure upon the book, and that's where they remain overnight. I don't even pay attention to the content of a book any longer. I used to. There was a time when I did.
What can you say about that?
People would often ask, "What is your favorite book, Donald?" And decades ago, I might have had an answer for that, but I don't have an answer for that question any longer. And I think that's because I sense a type of universal voice coming from all of these books. And I may open a book and my eyes will land upon a set of words or a sentence, a passage that will speak to me at a moment when I very much need it. And I found this to be true of all kinds of books. So I can't really single out a book or its content as being more special over another. And there's a parallel there with people. And that parallel of not paying attention to the content of a book might also relate to not paying attention to the content of a person. I look for now the damage in a book, its weakness, or what is hurting it, and try to find that way of repair. You meet up with people every day who, everyone has their challenges and everyone has their stresses, which will invariably cause weakness and hurt and even disease. And the aspect of who they are, or what's going on in their mind, or what their content is not as important in those moments as addressing that weakness.
Is it something like unconditional love?
Yes, you might say that. You're just simply feeling that person as a human.
So you mentioned that in the past you've occasionally, your eyes have fallen on a passage that, and it's been serendipitous, you felt like it's spoken to you or it was sort of what you needed to hear at that moment. Can you think of an example of that?
Oh, I can. It was within the past year. I was going through an incredibly difficult time and struggle. And I came in one morning, and that struggle was acute. And I sat down and had a stack of books to the left of me to be worked on. But I had to pause, and I just closed my eyes, and I felt myself crying out, "How am I going to deal with this?" And after that moment passed, I picked up the first book on the stack opened it, and my eyes fell upon a sentence from that book. And it was a sentence that absolutely answered that question so precisely that I couldn't help but feel the guidance in that, from that book.
You see, this is why, out of all the many books that have come into Donald's workshop, he doesn't have a set-in-stone favorite. He says he never knows when a particular volume will jump out from the others.
For that moment, on that day, that book was my most favorite book in all my life.
Do you remember the sentence or the gist of it?
I do. Whatever struggle you have met, find its meaning and it will cease to be a struggle. Now, granted, that's not some incredibly profound piece of wisdom. It's the kind of thing anyone would probably advise another in the time of need. But coming at that precise time, after asking a question to which that answer was so perfectly fitted, gave me immense comfort and hope and strength.
It's like a little hidden gift from the book to you.
Yes, exactly. You feel that from pieces of writing, wherever they happen to be. And when they come up at times, you feel a great value that the book is still around.
Donald Voss is the King County Public Library System's bookmender. And it was looking like he'd be the last of them, but then he got some good news. An apprentice has just joined him, someone Donald can share his knowledge with before he retires. This is Sound Effect on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is one of many.
Fight, fight, fight for Washington State. Win the victory. We're going to win this day for crimson and gray. Best in the West, you know we'll all do our best. So on. Fight till the end. Honor and glory we must win. So fight, fight, fight for Washington State and victory.
Cameron McCoy may not win many singing competitions, but to students and alumni of Washington State University, there are few melodies more glorious. To say Cougars have school spirit is a wild understatement. And if you have any in your life, then you know they don't hesitate to remind you. Now, Cameron and many other members of Coug Nation have reached a significant milestone in letting their flags fly. Like actual flags. Cameron and his accomplices in the Old Crimson Booster Club have made it their business to get a Coug to a different city every week during college football season and wave the WSU flag in the background on TV. Cameron and I sat down to talk about what it means to be a Coug and why they've made more than 200 consecutive appearances on this particular sports show. What exactly is ESPN Game Day?
Oh, it's a football-oriented show that shows up every Saturday during the college football season.
Alabama, and I don't know if you guys, but Alabama's mad at Ole Miss.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and when Ole Miss beat them two out of three times, they've made Alabama mad. I'm telling you, payback.
And they talk about all things college football and sometimes about WSU.
So what makes it different from any of the gazillions of other sports shows on ESPN or any other network?
This show has a cult following that is incredible. It whenever they started to go from campus to campus, it just started to explode. And so if you tune in on Saturdays, you'll see crowds of people, all sorts of crazy and creative signs.
So how did this tradition get started? Maybe you can just spell out what it is, first of all.
Yeah, so this is it's a tradition that was grassroots-oriented. A gentleman by the name of Tom Pounds decided that he wanted to drive over to Austin, Texas one day and wave a Crimson Cougar flag on the college game day set. Happened to be back in the time when WSU was really good,
and he was hoping that WSU could be a host for the game day show.
Because game day goes to a different college every week, and so
that's right. They
you wanted to entice them to come to Pullman.
Yeah, they generally pick the best game or most intriguing matchup, and they'll go locate on that campus, and they'll choose that on usually Sunday or Monday. And we've been going since October 18th, 2003, waving a Cougar flag on college game day.
Thousands of people, hundreds of signs. But in this spectacle, there has been one constant for more than 14 years. Across more than 25 states, on more than 40 campuses, one particular school's flag has flown. One. Why? What for? How? I guess there's one simple answer. It's a Coug thing.
Every week?
Every time the show is on at a college campus, we're there. Yeah, we've had, this week will be 205 consecutive game day shows for us.
So, in the early days, how did you accomplish getting a Cougar flag in the right place at the right time every week?
You know, it's a tradition that was grassroots oriented. A gentleman by the name of Tom Pounds. So he would go on the message board and say, hey, they're going to pick your place that week. And hopefully somebody who was on the board lived in that general area. And they would say, well, send it to me. Here's my address. And so he would ask the person who had it last to, you know, put the flag in a tube and ship it off.
So have you had any close calls in terms of keeping the streak going?
I think it was 3 years ago, and the flags got stuck in a transit facility in Mississippi somewhere. We had no idea how to get them out of there and get them to Arizona in time. And so I had to call ESPN up, and it just so happened that we had just donated one of the original flags to them to hang in their hallway. They asked us to provide that because they recognized it as the best tradition in college football, according to them. So they remodeled their cafe and hung up an old crimson there. And so we had to call them and say, hey, guys, we need your help. Kind of need that flag. Can you pull it down and send it to us? And of course, they embraced that and made a big show out of it. And we worked with UPS to do express critical shipping, same day air, basically. And
well, that's the thing that, like, if you have to send an organ for transplant or something, right?
Absolutely, yeah. This is emergency stuff. You have to get it there immediately. So they filmed taking the flag down and tracked it across the country for us, and it showed up with plenty of time to spare. But just in case, we sent a guy out of Spokane with an additional flag. So we actually ended up having, I think, five flags there that week. That was pretty funny.
Oh, man. So what do you think it is about WSU? I mean, do you think that this would work at another school?
You know, I used to think it might. And, you know, I work in higher education and been to a lot of schools, and there's a lot of schools with a lot of pride. But there's not the same kind of camaraderie that you have being a Washington State grad. You can't explain Pullman to people. People have to go there and experience it. And anybody who's spent a significant amount of time in Pullman and at WSU really understands that this is about taking care of each other and being as isolated as you can be in Pullman, Washington. You got to build some relationships, and I think those endure. And the pride behind Old Crimson tends to endure as well. And you know, when we have the opportunity to answer why you do this, and it's a different alumnus who's waving the flag any given week, the answer is really always the same, and that's it's a Coug thing.
It's a Coug thing. Well, Cameron McCoy graduated from WSU in 1998. He is a lifelong Coug, and he's the coordinator of the group Old Crimson. Cameron, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is One of Many. So, sticking with sports for now, if you were to poll Seattle sports fans about who their favorite Seahawk is, or maybe even their favorite person in all of Seattle, you'd probably end up with the name Russell Wilson. And if you're a true Hawks fan, especially one who stuck with them through the lean years, then Wilson must walk on water for you, right? Well, Sound Effect producer and lifelong Seahawks fan Kevin Kniestad has found his Russell Wilson worship slipping over the past few seasons, and now he finds himself on the outside of this very large base of fans looking in. he shares this essay. My earliest memory of watching the Seahawks goes back to when I was probably 3 or 4. I remember sitting in the basement with my dad, with a game on TV, and hearing the announcer saying, "There's a penalty flag down." Since I had no understanding of the game, I imagined that somewhere in the stadium there was a guy standing by a flagpole, lowering and raising a flag that said penalty on it every time a player did something bad. Once I learned to read, I would open up the sports section in the Seattle Times every week to the team roster and memorize the jersey numbers of all the players. Through the 80s, I watched Denver Broncos quarterback John Elway pick our team apart, and the 90s for the Hawks can really only be described as dismal. But I never missed a game. In February of 2006, I returned to my father's basement to watch the Seahawks in their first Super Bowl. I felt that with all the terrible games we had watched together when I was a kid, this was a moment we needed to celebrate together. The officiating in the game was terrible, as later admitted by the officiating committee, and the Seahawks lost the Super Bowl as a result of it. As a diehard, broken-hearted fan, I could have written off football then and there forever. But as the next season and the season after that and the season after that came and went, I still never missed a game. When Russell Wilson was drafted by the Seahawks in 2012, all of the, quote, experts were saying he was too short to be a professional quarterback. But like anyone who wants to prove the pundits wrong, Wilson worked really, really hard. His catchphrase became, "The separation is in the preparation."
The separation is in the preparation.
By 2013, Russell Wilson found himself the leader of an incredibly talented team. And in February of 2014, he found himself the quarterback of the Seahawks that won their first ever Super Bowl. I was all in on Russell Wilson. When the next season rolled around, the Seahawks looked every bit as good as they did the previous year and made it back to the Super Bowl for the second consecutive year. The game was close, it was exciting, and in a moment that makes every Seahawks fan curl up and start rocking back and forth in the fetal position, this happened.
Lynch in the backfield, Russell looks, throws inside, oh my gosh!
He's intercepted at the goal line!
Russell Wilson threw an interception at the goal line of what would have been back-to-back Super Bowl wins. I remember standing in a bar, shoulder-to-shoulder, with 100 fans, ready to lose our minds. Instead, the entire place fell immediately silent. So, yeah, I was upset, sure, but no reason to get carried away and abandon my team. Hawks fan for life, right? But it was what I started hearing in the days, weeks, and months to come that started to create separation between me and fellow Seahawks fans. Everyone I heard, friends, sports radio hosts, you name it, blamed everyone for what happened, except Russell Wilson. I would say in conversation, Wilson is the one who threw the ball, right?
Yeah, but the coaches never should have called that play.
But he threw the ball, right?
Yes, but the wide receiver should have tried harder to catch the ball.
But he threw the ball, right?
Yeah, but.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, but.
Yeah.
In fact, the only person who actually said that it was Russell Wilson's fault was Russell Wilson.
You know, I put the blame on me. You know, I'm the one who threw it. So, you know, it's something you learn from, something you grow from. I'm proud of our guys.
From that point on, I started to see this sort of protectiveness of Russell Wilson intensify and, at least to me, become wildly irrational. Later in 2015, Wilson was profiled in Rolling Stone magazine, where he talked about how a bottled water company that he invested in was responsible for miracle cures, including a concussion he received. "I banged my head during the Packers game in the playoffs, and the next day I was fine," says Wilson in the article. "It was the water." I'd bring this up to friends who would respond with, "Well, maybe it was the water." "Do you really think there is a magic water that cures concussions in 24 hours?" I'd ask. "No, but if Russell Wilson said it worked, who's to say it didn't?" As time went on, the defensiveness of fans ramped up even further. If Russell Wilson just did his job, it was the most breathtaking thing ever to my friends, and they'd say, "See, Kevin? He's amazing." If he didn't do his job, and I was caught rolling my eyes or shaking my head, it would be, "F*** you, Kevin." There was no in-between.
Show me the meaning of being lonely.
So
Several things then started to happen. I started to make a point of everything Wilson was doing wrong because I wanted the diehard Wilson fans to look at him the same way I did, as a human being capable of messing up, and sometimes messing up pretty big time. And as a result, those diehard fans dug in their heels even deeper, insistent that he is capable of no flaw. The other thing that happened is this season, for the first time in my life, I started watching less and less of the Seahawks. If I was out watching a game, I'd often go home at halftime. If I was home watching it, I'd often take a nap in the second half. I bought a Trayvon Boykin jersey. Trayvon is the third string quarterback for the Seahawks, out of a sort of protest of Wilson. I'd even have a list of statistical failures of Wilson written down on a piece of paper in my wallet to pull out any time I needed to back up one of my criticisms. The worst part is, I hate myself for it. I have always supported my team no matter what. And to be honest, as a person, Russ is about as much of a professional football-playing Boy Scout as it gets. Weekly trips to visit sick kids at Children's Hospital, tweeting out Bible verses. But even Edgar Martinez, Seattle's favorite sports darling of all time, and one hell of a nice guy, took his share of flack. And you know what? That was okay. Seattle sports fans suffered for decades and needed that star athlete to lead them to the sports promised land. I get it. But I would argue that even Moses had flaws, and so does Russell Wilson. Still, I feel like the villain. The sad thing is, when something starts spiraling out of control, becomes a pattern and a mindset, it's really hard to change. I want to change. I want to fix it. I read somewhere once that it takes 7 days for something to become a habit, and can take at least 7 days to break a habit. The Seahawks play every 7 days. Maybe that's just what I need here. Between this week's game and the next, I'll work every day to remember some of the great Russell Wilson moments and show up to the game at the end of the week and cheer him on like I once did. And maybe with each week, it'll get easier. And maybe, just maybe, one fan out there will see the change in me and be able to break their own trend and treat Wilson like someone who isn't that different from us. Imperfect, mistake-making humans. Sometimes, when things are going well, we forget to remind ourselves of a long stretch of time when they weren't. But maybe if we all think back to when we were kids, sitting in our parents' basement, watching our team getting pummeled week after week, we can embrace each other for any mixed feelings, knowing we all want the same thing in the end, to absolutely annihilate every other team in the league without any mercy whatsoever. My city right behind me. If I fall, they got me. Learn from that failure, gain humility, and then we keep marching. Sound effects, Kevin Canista. This is the moment. Tonight is the night. We'll fight till it's over. Our show is produced by Kevin and Jennifer Wing with Shane Mailing. Thanks this week to Peter Mullenix and Rosemary Leifer, and to our St. Francis students, Gwendolyn Schaefer, Rachel Fry, Sarah Ray, Mackenzie Treichel, Tyler Valdez, Gabriel Hamilton, Gina Morella, and Payne Roberts. We get multimedia help from Parker Miles Blom. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. May I recommend a podcast to you? How about Sound Effect? Subscribe, rate, and review us, and send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week with stories of war and peace. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.